Instead of rambling,
interject.
Yes. You want to start with background and that type of thing. Yes. Yes. Very good. We are now. Is it? Sure. My background, I guess, as a university professor, is quite different than what you typically think, because I came from a background of parents, one of whom came as an immigrant from Sweden, came to this country at the age of 12. Her family had come in a series of installments, and incidentally, my mother is now 85 and living in the Middle West. But she came to this country after her father had arrived in one wave, some sisters and brothers had arrived in a second wave, and she and her mother and a sister had arrived in a third wave.
What year was that, Angela?
That was basically when she came, about 1906. Tragedy immediately met them, in the sense that my mother's sister, who was 2 years younger than she, contracted meningitis aboard the vessel and died the day they landed. So her first encounter in America was a funeral service. That was in June. In November, her mother died of cancer at the Immigrant Hospital in Brooklyn. And my mother, not having, of course, a source of livelihood, and her father not being able to support her, immediately had to go to work, as they called it in the beginning of the century, in place. That is, you worked into some wealthy person's home. And with no knowledge of the English language, that's where she worked, and worked for several years.
Had she been educated at all?
Her education was through the 8th grade, or probably 7th grade in Sweden. In this country, she's never had one day of education, never learned the language from anybody, but reads it very well, speaks it, and is an avid reader to this day, but has never had any formal instruction. Eventually, her father, concerned about her well-being in the big city of New York, through a minister whom he knew, decided to send her to a place in Illinois called Rockford, Illinois, which was sort of a Swedish Mecca. And there she went, and immediately went to work in a factory. It was called Hedorf Piano Company, and they used women in assembly lines. And while there, and when my grandfather, eventually followed, plus two of her sisters, there she eventually met my father, who was born of immigrant Swedish parents.
So she basically was sent there on her own and then boarded?
Yes. She was there and put under the care of this minister who knew people who lived in that city. And then her father, my grandfather, came out not long thereafter to establish a home for her and an older sister. And then he, in time, remarried a Swedish immigrant who was in Rockford, Illinois. Therefore, culturally, she didn't have what we'd call anything that was American. It was essentially her Swedish baggage, culturally, that she brought with her.
Was this minister involved with any of this wooden
boarding? No, he was involved with an interesting movement that's been European in nature called the Free Church Movement, a movement to get the people out from under a state-supported, state-sponsored church. For example, in Sweden, the Lutheran Church is the state church. And for many years in Sweden, there were conventicle acts that prohibited people from meeting in homes or in any place other than the established place, the church. That had pretty well broken by the time my grandfather appeared on the scene, but it was still historically there. Mm-hmm. And he became a part of it and became what you might call a lay minister. He was never an ordained person, but sort of a lay preacher. He went to sort of a preacher school in Sweden. It wasn't for an ordained Lutheran clergyman. It was for the free people, the free church people. It's a kind of a grassroots movement. If you've seen the film The Immigrants, I don't know if you've seen that, but it's I've seen it in Swedish with the English subtitles. And though that is centered in the 1850s, the things hadn't changed that much, even by the late 19th and early 20th century.
But does that mean that the environment in which she grew up was somewhat more liberal then?
No, in many ways, perhaps more conservative, to some degree, at least theologically. The whole idea was that the Lutheran Church had become an arm of the government. Mm. And as an arm of the government, it was no longer training ministers, as my grandfather thought, and others who were part of that movement, in an understanding of the freedom to interpret Scripture or Bible as you thought, rather than the way a clergyman taught you. Now, in that sense, it would be liberal. In another sense, perhaps conservative, because I think within the Lutheran Church, there was an attempt to reconcile, for example, perhaps the teachings of Plato and Aristotle with those of Paul or that type of thing. Well, this was her background, and as I say, she came eventually to Rockford, Illinois, and there lived, and through circumstances, through friends, she met my father, who was born in Pennsylvania, and his parents were both immigrants from Sweden, so he was the first generation. He had to quit school. He was the oldest of seven children. He had to quit school at the end of the sixth grade to work in the coal mines of Pennsylvania. This was understood. This would happen as each child, or each male child, got to that age. You go to work in the coal mines, where my grandfather went. So my father became a coal miner at the age of 12. Yet interestingly enough, he was an ardent Republican. You know, this is amazing when you think of the labor conditions. You'd almost think that he would have embraced, perhaps, the Democratic philosophy, but he seemed to have adhered pretty much to that of the Republican Party, and until his death 9 years ago, my dad was still a very, very strong Republican.
Did he, during his very early years, was he at all affected by the unionization by the United Mine Workers?
Not at all, because what he did when he left this spot in Clearfield County, Pennsylvania, a little town called Lance, he went to Jamestown, New York, where some of his brothers and sisters likewise eventually went, got involved in meat cutting in a butcher shop. From there, he went to a furniture factory. Jamestown has long been known for its furniture manufacturing establishment. Then, through cousins, heard of the fact that Rockford, Illinois was a unique spot, and was until probably World War II, as a furniture manufacturing area. He came to Rockford and worked in a furniture factory. Just prior to my birth, and out of looking for greater security, because there was a lot of layoffs in furniture factory business, he took the examination for the Rockford Police Department and became a policeman, and worked 7 days a week, 12 hours a day, no time off. So through my infancy and my early childhood, my dad had strange hours. You know, sometimes it was 3 to 11, sometimes 11 to 7, that type of thing. And growing up in a two-family flat for those first 6 years, and no doors to close from bedrooms to dining room, but only drapes, as it were, to close, my mother's responsibility was to keep me and a sister who was 3 years older somewhat quiet so Dad could sleep, you know, that type of thing.
Now, then, through the auspices, basically, of this ministry, then?
My mother and father? No. They met. My mother, I can't tell you exactly how, she became acquainted with my dad's cousins, several of his female cousins. And being that he was then, you know, looking for a date, and they had met my mother, probably at this head of piano company, is the way she was introduced to him. And this is how they started to go together. So they were married in 1915. My sister was born in 1916, and I was born in 1919, and we're the only two children in the family. So as you look at my background first, you see that it is, in some ways, I suppose one could say I was culturally deprived. Not by their decision, but just by my own environment. But my dad, and including my mother, always felt that America was the place, and that there were opportunities available here that had never been available, particularly to my mother, and my father never felt they were available really to him. And therefore, a great deal of emphasis was placed on education. That the way you get ahead in this country is to be educated. Therefore, I was encouraged, you know, do well, do well. And part of it, I think, was that in this concept of doing well, I always wanted to make the honor roll so that I'd please them, you know, because that was their desire. My sister did not go on to college. She graduated from high school in 1933 in the midst of the Depression. But she turned to my father and mother, and likewise to me, and said, I want my brother to have a college education, and if I can do anything to help him, I will at least make some contribution. So she went to work as a dental assistant and made very little money, but she paid for my room when I went to college as a freshman in 1936, when I graduated from high school. And my dad and mother, I know, sacrificed. I did work summers. I got odd jobs on the campus. It was a time when it was exceedingly difficult to get jobs during the summer. I did get a job one summer in a furniture factory. One summer, I worked at a lake, got $10 a week for 12 hours of work per day and never one day off. And for the 10 weeks in the summer, I ended up with $100 that I hadn't spent one cent. I likewise had jobs in a shoe store, whatever was available is what I took, so that I might in some way contribute. Then on the campus, I worked in the cafeteria and so forth. But I graduated third in my class at Wheaton College in Wheaton, Illinois.
Let me back.
Okay.
High school, did you work in the
high school? No. Then I, for a while, had a paper route. But it's amazing, if you go back to that period, there were just no jobs available. As I see it today, and I see high school kids working in McDonald's or Jack in the Box or any of these places, there were no jobs available. I would try to cut lawns, for example. People would say, well, we'd love to, we can't afford a penny. On the college campus later, even when I worked, I'd get 25 cents for taking a trunk from somebody's attic that they wanted moved, and to call the College Placement Bureau, Employment Bureau, do you have anybody to move a trunk for us? You get 25 cents. Of course, but fortunately, expenses were different. My room was $2.50 a week, for example. But in that sense, it was a somewhat impoverished experience, because my father, during the Depression, though on the police department, was not paid any cash. He was paid in city bonds, which nobody wanted. But finally, through a grocery man who was rather well fixed financially, he took my dad's bonds that we might have food on the table.
How did he pay that?
And what little money he had saved, the mortgage company, he was fortunate he didn't lose his home, he paid only interest, nothing on principal. Hmm. And I know my mother, as far as aprons, she made aprons out of old flour sacks. My socks were mended and mended and mended. I don't remember getting much in the way of new clothes at all during my high school years. And yet, I never felt deprived. I felt like...
Did you also in some way expect to get a college before
you... Oh, yes. I, from the time I was a seventh grader, many of my teachers started to say, well, now you want to plan to go to college. This should be your objective. And one of the teachers in the junior high was a man by the name of Mr. Lufthal, who was a science teacher. And he, interestingly, was the brother-in-law of the girl that I eventually married. There's a great differential in age between my wife and this oldest sister in the family. So here it was, she was in junior high, this girl that I eventually married. I was in junior high, and her brother-in-law was a teacher. And he was the advisor for the High Y group, which is a YMCA group. I was a member of that. He took a keen interest in me, in the sense of encouraging me all the time. and said, Irv, you're going to go to college. Always keep that in mind. There's always a way. And I said, Les, I was at the position I could call him Les, it was Mr. Lussell. I said, Les, I guess I don't have that much optimism. I don't see how he can do it. He said, listen, there's always a way. Because he had found the way.
Let me ask you, wasn't that unusual, particularly in those days in junior high school, to address him by his first name?
How I had to be able to address him by his first name was that he went to the same church as I. And he was the choir director, and we had what we call a young people's choral group. He directed it. And so that's how I could call him Les. On the school campus, no way. But in that choral group, of which I was a member, and my wife was a member, that's where we got to know him as Les. But yes, never on the campus.
During those years, it seems like you had a lot of community activity and involvement in such, you mentioned, the choral group.
Yes.
And the Y.
Yes.
What was your life like out of school?
It was a very sheltered life. One is that we didn't have an automobile until 1931, when I was 12 years of age. We depended upon shoe leather. I walked to school most of the time, and that was a good 4 to 5 miles by the time I got to high school, about 2.5 miles to junior high. Not that far, but nevertheless, in the winter, it seemed quite far. I grew up in a very, very conservative environment, in the sense that you weren't allowed to do a lot of activities that probably young people were doing. For example, I couldn't go to a dance hall. I wasn't frequenting because I was lack of funds. I never got to go to a movie. There was no money to go to a movie. Much of my time was spent, I loved sandlot baseball in the summer. I loved skiing. There wasn't that much to ski, but there were city parks in which you could use typical skis, and sledding, and ice skating, that type of thing. That is, if you look at it, it's the typical type of things you'd associate, I guess, more or less with a small rural community. Mm-hmm. Even though it was a town of about 60,000 men, you nevertheless had your small neighborhoods. And those neighborhoods tended to be the nucleus of all your activities, or the church or the school. Those were the things. You see, the church I went to was a Swedish. It was this free church concept. And the sermons many times was preached in the Swedish language. But we did not speak Swedish in the home. Simply because my father had been born in this country, was very proud of that, and didn't want to speak the Swedish language. And my mother spoke it, the English language, very well, for never having studied it formally. And the only time she spoke Swedish would be if her sister came over, or friends came over. And then they eventually departed from it completely, too.
Mm.
Just didn't speak it.
Were the Swedes very well integrated into the community roster, or were they an immigrant pocket?
I would say they were pretty much of a pocket. The east side of Rockford was pretty much Scandinavian. There's a river that runs through the town. The east side had a very large Scandinavian population, Swedish, Norwegian, Danish. The south side, on the other side of the river, had a southern European population, and the north side, more of an Anglo-Saxon population. You could shop in that city where I lived, in some of the neighborhoods, and never have to learn the English language. But I didn't know one Swede who couldn't speak English. Because they said, we've got to be voters, we've got to be participants, we're living in this country, we must know the language. They still observe their customs, traditions, dishes, all the rest of it. But nothing, like my parents were never a part of such a thing as a Vasa lodge, whereas many Swedes would join these fraternal organizations by which they perpetuated even more their Swedish customs. I never felt that I was anything but an American. I never really, and wouldn't identify myself as being Swedish. Mm. I was ashamed if I would have to say that another language was even spoken in my home, if ever. It was that kind of a concept. Later, of course, I came back with regret, saying, what an opportunity I had that I didn't take hold of. Because your own peer group said, oh, you speak another language in your home? You know, who are you? You wanted to be identified with the American culture.
And education was one of
yeah.
the most effective.
That's right. It was the route by which you went. Mm-hmm.
Now, in your childhood, particularly, most of your friends drawn from this type of community?
Yes. Every one of them. Until I got to high school. There was only one high school in that community. So you had your neighborhood elementary school. By the time I got to junior high, I should make an exception. The junior high did draw people from the south side of Rockford, which were Italians and blacks and so forth. So I did get an integrating experience there. But the high school brought everybody together. If you want to talk about integration, that was it. It was a large high school of about 3,800 to 4,000 students. And there you met the students from the south side, from the north side, and from other sides of the city with whom you had no contact previously. And there you did make friends. In fact, I made friends among black students with whom I corresponded when I later went away to college. They went away to college, and so we kept on a correspondence that way.
Did you go to each other's homes?
Yes. So that was a liberating kind of experience there, you might say, because of the high school being, you weren't bused in, you walked in. Mm-hmm. Or if you bused, it was at your expense. And I think in that sense, the city did better then than it does now, because it has a large number of high schools and junior high schools, and they're having to bus people mm-hmm. in order to integrate. But with the one high school, the integration, which of course was not a problem at that time, but nevertheless they were doing something of which they were completely unaware. But I thought then, a very meaningful cosmopolitan mm-hmm. education. And I would match the teachers that I had in both junior high and high school with any teachers that I have seen even to this day, or I would even say with professors I had in college. We even had PhDs teaching. In chemistry, we had a man with a PhD. Why? No jobs available. He taught at a junior high. I had some of the finest instructors in English, women who were dedicated beyond belief. This was their life. And gave of themselves their time in ways that I couldn't even begin to explain. And it's amazing, the ones who had the greatest impact on me were women instructors.
What was the ratio? Do you tell about this?
There weren't that many men teachers. I had one in history. When you took industrial arts, of course, you had men. Most of my instructors were women. And even when I took science, except for chemistry and physics, like when I took zoology, I had a woman instructor who made of me a biologist that when I went to college, I was a zoology major. Not a history major, but because of Minnie Langwell, was her name, a unique individual who taught me an awful lot about dissection, insect collection, and the rest. I just became an ardent zoologist, ornithologist, herpetologist, you know, all of them.
You seem to respond very positively to an awful lot of his teachers in your school.
Yes, I can never say that I had a teacher I didn't like. I don't mean to say that everyone was as effective as I looked back, but I never had a negative experience with any teacher. I felt they all were there to build me, to do something, to put things into my life. Not only subject matter, but value. One English teacher, for example, had every day the thoughts of the day, and there were unique quotations from literary personnel of the past. And those things did me a lot of good. Furthermore, when it came to writing, and I look particularly at my English instructors, the pains they took to evaluate your themes, which you wrote one every week, plus a long paper at the end of the semester. And you got two grades, one for content and one for grammatical usage. That was a whole policy of the English department. And years later, as I graduated from high school and went back, And I could only go back and just thank them. Because I thought they had done things for me that, especially one coming out of an immigrant home where you never heard correct English. And though I read a great deal and took a lot of books out of the public library, I did not own many books. The only books I ever got were gifts that friends and relatives gave me at Christmas or at my birthday, and they were generally the Tom Hardy Boy series and that type of thing. Her reading material came from the public library, just as mine. She'd go with me to the library. She'd get books. Plus the fact, another thing she did, she subscribed with her sister to a number of Swedish journals.
Mm.
And she read those, but she did not confine herself to Swedish. She read English. And, but I never had the experience as a child of anybody reading to me. I don't remember that anybody ever read to me in the home,
mm-hmm.
other than in the classroom, of course.
So until you actually learned to read yourself, there was really no...
So one can speak, you know, I look at people today and they tell me their handicaps. And I say, well, you know, I have handicaps too. But there was one thing that characterized my childhood and my adolescent period. And that's one word, love. My parents loved me, they cared for me, they sacrificed for me, and I always was a secure person. And I think that security,
mm.
and the reinforcement of saying, what you're doing, we say, right on. And my dad particularly was one who identified with what I was doing, because he always said, oh, I like it. And probably to illustrate that in the best way, I remember when I went away to college and I came home and I had finished my first semester, not that I had not been home in between times, but when I finished that first semester, he asked me, may I have the textbook that you used in your freshman English class? And there was a little book called, it was authored by William Scott, it was called Handbook in English. My dad literally wore out that book. He went through every exercise and typed them all out. Because by that time he had become a detective and he was having to write his own report. And he felt the necessity of doing it in good English. So he'd say, son, I'm going to write this, now you correct it. You know, that type of thing. But an eager person in that sense. So if I could say anything out of my childhood and even up to, you know, in my adulthood and to the age at which I find myself now, that with my own father, for example, when I saw him just 3 months before he died, which I never expected was going to happen, but my dad said to me something I'll never forget. He said, son, I love the ground you stand on. And, you know, what could have been better as a memory? And my mother is still living in the house where I grew up. We moved there when I was the age of 7, 1926. She's lived in that house for 51 years. On one side, our neighbors who have lived there since we moved in. The house was new. Their house was new. On the other side, the people who lived there since I went away to college as a freshman. Across the street, one family that's lived there since I was 8 years old. There aren't any communities you can go to where you still find the same people. My mother's a very alert person, and she's a very bright person. She's got a memory that is extremely sharp. We converse weekly on the telephone, and we see each other. Some ways, she flies out here, my wife and I fly back there. So we keep our contact. And of course, I have a sister who lives in that town, which is delightful because I would be concerned otherwise by my mother being alone.
Tell me, Junior, with the kind of encouragement you got since
you've been right.
Do you feel that you were, in some sense, in junior high school and in high school, somewhat singled out and encouraged on an individual basis, or that it was part of the general encouragement that was provided to
I think probably I was singled out. I was a student that was extremely competitive. I am even to this day, and I suffer from it, I'm a perfectionist. Not in every area, but in many areas. I make great demands on myself, which sometimes are greater than one should make. And I can say physically that a number of years ago I did get an ulcer, and I think that's a description of who I am, and I know who Irv Ahlquist is. But many of my teachers, many of them encouraged me. For example, in junior high, we had general foreign language. And in the eighth grade, in one semester you took French and German, and another semester you took Latin and Italian. Now this is interesting. No Swedish was offered in that time, and this was basically a Swedish community. It was then that you got encouragement as to which language you could go into. And I was encouraged to go into French, and so therefore I took French, a couple of years of French in high school. And also, out of interest, I decided to take some Spanish, because I got to know in high school someone I had never known before was a person of Mexican extraction. And I heard him speak the language, I loved the sound of it, and I decided to take some Spanish. I took a couple of years of Spanish in high school. I think one has to say that it was not every student was encouraged. I think if a teacher saw, I think this is typical often of teachers, if they see they have a student that wants to achieve and hopefully has some ability, they do encourage that kind of an individual. And I was encouraged all along the way. And in our high school, we never graduated as valedictorian or salutatorian, but they picked the highest 10 boys, the highest 10 girls. And I was in the highest 10 boys. And as a result, the principal, the vice principal, a counselor, did everything to see that, you know, what I wanted to do scholastically in the way of a college, that I would have all the information available. Well, I chose, largely because of the science teacher in junior high, whom I got to know extremely well, which is the director of the college, to go to a college just 70 miles from home called Wheaton College outside of Chicago. He had gone there. And a number of those students had been visiting in his home, and I got acquainted with them when I was in junior high and high school. And they gave me these glowing reports of what Wheaton College was like.
This was a very early time.
Yeah. I was 13, 14 years of age. Perhaps I should interject one other thing here. There was a math teacher by the name of Millicent Johnson who taught in that same junior high. And she became the advisor in the same church where I left of what we call the Intermediate Young People Society. And I was elected president of that group. She was the advisor. And she forced me to give public talks. So beginning at the age of 13 or 14, I, at one time, we had a big Thanksgiving concert in our church. I was 14 then. We brought out vocalists from Chicago. I emceed that whole evening, and there were 1,200 people there. And I thank her to this day. She's living in Rockford. She's a woman now about 68, 69 years of age. And when I saw her in June of this year, I said, Millicent, I said, you know, you're the one that forced me to get up and talk. And I do a great deal of public speaking. Even now, I speak in over service clubs and various kinds of groups. And I said, Millicent, I have you to thank, because you pushed me and said, you can do it, and you're going to do it. So there have been many people, as I see it, who built things into me, and I can recognize it, and I'm thankful for it.
Well, you had thought in those early years, beginning with 13, expected that you were going to go to college. Did you have, at that point, any special interest?
Definitely. All right. Not so much at the age of 14. But particularly at the age of about 15 or 16, I had skipped a year in elementary school. They used that concept of acceleration at that time. So when I was about a junior, when I was about 16, and I took the zoology class with this mini Langwell, I became keenly interested in zoology. And through my family doctor, thought medicine might be the thing I would do, but not confirmed in my mind. That following summer, my junior year in high school, a fellow named Dr. Stanley Olson, chancellor, incidentally, for the Northeastern Medical Schools of Ohio, who was 5 years older than I, came that summer. He was just finishing his first year of medical school, and he was going to be the advisor for this intermediate young people's group, because this woman had stepped out. So he met me two and three times a week. He was having to work We got together, we planned all the things for the kids, you know, this was it. And he kept saying to me, Irv, you've got to be a medical doctor. You know, he just kept encouraging me. And I believed that that's what I was going to do. And I graduated from high school and started at Wheaton, where he had also done his undergraduate work. So he was in medical school here at the Governor of Chicago. He made arrangements for me to come into Chicago to the Cook County Hospital and observe surgery. And I spent many Saturdays in the arena with medical students when I was a freshman in college watching surgery. In college, in my freshman year, I became disillusioned with zoology. I liked it, but there's something very significant. The professor killed it. And that's why I keep saying to people, the teacher can make the class. It's not the subject, all of it. A man who showed no excitement, no enthusiasm. In fact, we as freshmen called him the missing link because he looked like it. Had no relationship to students. We could have been wax figures out there as far as he was concerned. I came back after my freshman year disillusioned. In fact, intending not to go back to Wheaton, and was given a scholarship to Beloit College in Beloit, Wisconsin. I received a full scholarship. And yet, it would involve my living at home and taking the bus 15 miles, Rockford's right on almost the borderline of Wisconsin and Illinois. And I thought, college isn't living at home. College is being away from home. And I had made some good friends in that freshman year. And in August, decided, I'm going back. And not knowing whether I continued to be a zoology major. And this would interest you. I had a woman professor in history who had recently gotten her PhD at UC Berkeley. And she taught a course called The History of the Americans. There was no text, only an intensive syllabus, and an incredible amount of reading, and a book of the month, plus that, and constant quizzing. But I never learned a course as effectively as I learned that one.
Is the syllabus primarily documents?
No, the syllabus was only a guide. Here's the topic. These are the sources you look at now. Here are the secondary accounts you look at. It was simply a guide. It had actually been done by Bancroft students at Berkeley. And she took it with her as a unique way of integrating the course. Because I say I never worked as hard, but I never learned as much. Lamberta Vilgat was her name. In fact, she retired 2 years ago as professor at Wheaton. And I've been in contact. Yes. At that institution, few people left. Amazing. Several professors I had just retired in the last 3 years. They haven't always had a compulsory retirement, a good retirement of 70 or more. But Lamberta Vilgat showed me something about history that I had never seen. History was never a problem with me, but I never saw that it was exciting. You know, to me, I memorized a lot of facts, and I could pass the examinations in high school. But she saw, or she was able to show me, that history was also philosophical, that it was processed, that it wasn't just an accumulation of facts. And just a lot of information. As a result of her, though I never had another course for him because he didn't teach me another history, because he also crossed over into sociology, I became a history major. Very much incidentally to the disappointment of this Stanley Olson, or Bill Olson, his father, Stanley W. He couldn't believe that I would betray him, you know, that type of thing. In fact, even to this day, I saw him in June also when I was back in the Middle West. He said, I still think you should have been a medical doctor or like me, a medical educator. And I said, but you know, I'm awfully happy at what I'm doing. And that's what really counts, really being happy with the doing. But I had the unusual people, I really believe, whether it was an undergraduate work or even if we go beyond that after my master's degree, when I thought, this is it. And one of the reasons, incidentally, that I decided not to go into medicine is not only because I was a little disappointed in the zoology department, but I was afraid financially that my dad told me, there's no way I can help you any further. The bachelor's degree is it. And I lived in a community where the pressure was unbelievable. It's very hard, I think, for people to understand, but the pressure was like this. College is like going from first grade, second grade, third grade, fourth grade. And if you don't finish in exactly 4 years, and then you go here and there, then you must be finished. Well, I saw no way of my going to medical school. And yet a very unique thing happened. I got my bachelor's, and then I got a scholarship at the University of Illinois to pursue a master's degree. And I took it and decided to do it in history. And my thoughts were, I'll be, you know, someday a high school teacher. Mm-hmm. Dr. Theodore Calvin Pease was chairman of the department in whose seminar I was enrolled, one of the seminars. It was a seminar on the Middle West, asked me, what are your intentions? You get a master's degree is the end for you? And I said, yeah. He said, no. He said, I want you to apply for one of the departmental scholarships. I said, Dr. P, I have no thought of going after a PhD. He said, I think you should. Which again, I think indicates that all through my academic life, there have been people that have always encouraged me. And in many ways, some of it just by moral encouragement, and others where he thought it was financial assistance.